This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Cooler temperatures and changing foliage are signs of fall. Another indicator is the start of oyster season. But before those fresh oysters make it to your dinner table, they are harvested adhering to strict guidelines enforced by the FDA. These policies were developed using data on temperature and bacteria levels collected from the Gulf Coast. Now, a team of researchers and scientists across the state are involved in a study to determine if bacteria levels in North Carolina waters differ from the Gulf. Postdoctorate researcher at the University of North Carolina's Institute of Marine Science, Dr. Brett Freilich, says the bacteria Vibrio vulnificus is commonly found in waters where oysters are harvested, and eating them raw increases the likelihood of being infected.
Typically, the people that come down with the disease, which can be quite deadly, are men who are over 40 who drink.
People with liver impairment, diabetes, or any other disease that affects the immune system are also at risk.
These bacteria can cause illnesses ranging from just upset stomachs and diarrhea, or even death in extreme cases from the bacteria spreading throughout your body and attacking your organs, and your system just shuts down.
The simplest way to prevent being infected by the disease is to steam the oysters 3 to 5 minutes, which kills the harmful bacteria. The Food and Drug Administration aims to keep those who insist on eating raw oysters safe by imposing restrictions on how oysters are harvested, minimizing the chance for bacteria to grow. Dr. Freilich says the restrictions limit the amount of time it takes from the harvest of an oyster to when it's put on ice.
As soon as they pull the first oyster out of the water, the clock starts ticking for when they have to bring them to a certain temperature. When those restrictions are at their greatest, that of course limits the amount of time they can harvest, and it limits the distance at which they can harvest the oysters before they have to start bringing them back. Add those restrictions in, and it lowers the amount of landings, of oyster landings, that you're going to get, you know, from those endeavors.
These restrictions are normally put into place during warm weather harvesting months. When oystermen aren't able to meet those requirements, they have to sell the product at a lower quality, which means less profit. Some, including Dr. Freilich, feel the FDA's regulations are too burdensome and don't accurately reflect the unique conditions of our coastal areas.
Those restrictions are put in place based on data collected from the Gulf Coast and their oysters and their particular set of bacteria. We get lumped into those restrictions here in the state of North Carolina based solely on our average water temperature and not on any data based on the bacteria that are currently in our waters.
Dr. Freilich and a team of scientists are involved in a research project that started in January that involves gathering information about the different types of bacteria specific to our coastal waters. The study is funded by a donation from Dr. Barbara Entwistle, the Vice Chancellor for Research at the University of North Carolina. The goal is to develop a salinity and temperature profile that can serve as an indicator of risk of infection when consuming raw oysters.
I'm the one who shucks the oysters, pulls out the meats, and actually does a lot of the bacterial analysis, or at least a good portion of it.
The North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries collects oyster samples twice a week from 4 to 6 different locations along the coast. Then they're taken to the Institute of Marine Sciences lab in Morehead City, where Dr. Freilich shucks the oysters, dilutes them in a saline solution, and makes an oyster smoothie of sorts. Blending the oyster meat allows them to access the bacteria contained inside the inner tissues.
Once the oysters are liquefied, I pull them out and I put them on different petri plates that have various antibiotics or various nutrients so we can tell the different bacteria apart. I give those a day or so to grow, and I pull them out the next day and I count and identify specific ones.
Samples that require further examination are frozen and sent to the University of North Carolina at Charlotte for study. Their research has been going on for 9 months, and Dr. Freilich says they're seeing results.
Our salinities are actually much higher, and for some types of these bacteria, that higher salinity has a negative effect on the bacteria. And so the increased salinity actually keeps those numbers lower, and therefore our oysters tend to have less of those bacteria.
Currently, the FDA only considers salinity and temperature as factors that cause bacteria growth. But as part of the study, Dr. Freilich is also trying to determine if pH, or the amount of dissolved material in the water, has any effect on the amount of bacteria present in North Carolina oysters versus Gulf oysters. The study is expected to conclude in early 2014, and a presentation of the findings will be made to the FDA. Dr. Frelick hopes to prove that a one-size-fits-all method of regulating oyster harvest is not the answer.
Rather than, say, North Carolina specifically, it would be nice if this became like an East Coast, Mid-Atlantic region. Rather, you know, like if there were a Gulf Coast region and then there were a Mid-Atlantic region, rather than just everybody in the nation following the same guidelines.
Dr. Frelick hopes they can secure funding to extend the study for another year. For Public Radio East, I'm Jared Brumbaugh. As we head into a cooler weekend, cyclists of all stamina levels are hoping the great weather holds out for next weekend's Cycling for the Coast fundraiser. Public Radio East is a proud media sponsor for the North Carolina Coastal Federation's latest fundraiser. Today, Public Radio East's Mac McKee speaks with Federation spokesperson Sarah Phillips about the many ways you can take part in helping promote education and issues important to Eastern North Carolina's delicate coastal habitat.
Sarah, I know you do a lot of things at the North Carolina Coastal Federation. Can you tell me what your job is there?
Anytime anyone calls and looks for any kind of projects or education with the Federation, they are sent to me. And basically, during the school year, I work a lot with students. I work with about 10 or 15 schools and 5 coastal counties here in the area. And anytime students or volunteers or adults want to get involved with the Federation with any of our habitat restoration projects, we do a lot of oyster and marsh restoration.
Basically, your job is an out-of-school educator, so to speak. A lot of times we talk about how important education is, but there's always time for fun. This Cycling for the Coast is certainly it. How did the Cycling for the Coast event get started with the North Carolina Coastal Federation?
Well, the cycling event was something new for us. A lot of our work focuses on habitat restoration and getting out into the marsh and planting marsh grass or putting oyster shells back into the water to create habitat for other oysters. And we wanted to kind of bring in a different type of group. We wanted to bring in someone that gets out there and exercises and enjoys the coast a different way. So this is our third year to do the cycling event.
Well, do you think that cyclists naturally fit that bill?
I do. I am a cyclist, and my coworker, Sam Bland, he's been helping organize this event as well. The both of us enjoy getting out and cycling, especially in the summer. Once you jump on your bike, you can see the beauty of the coast, but you can also get a little bit of a breeze, and you can see a lot more than maybe if you go for a run.
Now, Sarah, how much money has been raised approximately over the previous 2 years of the cycling events?
Well, all of the funds are going to our education programs. As you may know, education over the past couple of years, especially working for a nonprofit, education money has been hard to come by. And so the past 2 years, we've raised over $20,000 just from the cycling event. We're hoping this year to raise another $10,000 or so.
And of course, success always breeds success, and I'm certain that the event will be just as successful this year.
Yeah, I hope so. Every year we've had more and more people, and that's kind of the goal. As with any event, the more you do it, the more, just by word of mouth, things get passed around, and people come back year after year and bring their friends or family or tell someone else about the event. So we're hoping that every year becomes more and more successful.
Now, Sarah, how do you register for the event, or even at this short notice, do you still have time to register to participate?
You do. The event is September the 21st, so next Saturday, but you can definitely register basically up to the day. All of the money, 100% of the proceeds go to the Federation, which is a great organization to help out, and they can go to nccoast.org.
Now, Sarah, this would be an important question for someone like me who is not an experienced cyclist under any circumstance or an athlete at all. So do you have to be a super cyclist in order to successfully participate in the event?
Not everyone is a super cyclist. We always like to tell people, a ride, not a race. And so everyone, all ages, from kids riding beach cruisers, adults riding beach cruisers, we have some recumbent bikes that people bring. We have the smallest distance is a 20K, which is just 12 miles, so that's doable for most people. And then there are two other distances, a 40K, about 25 miles, and an 80K. The 80K is definitely more geared towards people that are pretty serious cyclists.
Can you tell us the dates and times and where the beginning point and the end point will be for this cycling event?
So the cycling event starts on Saturday, September the 21st at 8 o'clock in the morning. Everyone needs to meet at Fort Macon State Park at the Visitor Center. That's where the ride will begin and end for all distances. So each distance will leave kind of a staggered start. I have volunteers along the whole island, so it's a very easy ride out and back. You have people along the way telling you when to turn, and then there is also an after party for everyone to attend that is registered at McCurdy's Restaurant in Atlantic Beach.
Now, for any additional information, how can folks get in touch with the Federation?
For any additional information, the website is the best place to go, so nccoast.org, and look for the pelican riding the bicycle, and there's a lot of information there about most questions that people would have, and then people can also just contact me. My information is there as well.
All right, Sarah, well, thank you so much for being a part of the program today.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
This week, a new state park opened in Cumberland County. Totaling more than 4,300 acres, Carver's Creek State Park is a place where people can enjoy the outdoors and catch a glimpse of a historical home that once belonged to a member of the Rockefeller family. I spoke with Park Superintendent Jane Connolly about their plans for the site and how they'll protect the land and history.
Carver's Creek State Park is currently 4,330 acres. However, the only area that's open to the public right now is around 500 acres, which is our interim development area known as the Long Valley Farm Access Area. Most of the park is longleaf pine ecosystem or mixed hardwood, you know, oak, maples and things like that mixed with pine. And we also have some open country with native grasses and meadows.
Now, you said about 500 acres of the park is open to visitors right now. What kinds of things can people do when they come to the park?
Well, yeah, when people arrive to Long Valley Farm Access Area, you can picnic, hiking, and fishing at the mill pond. Like all state parks, it's a chance to get out into nature and be outside.
I wonder, with the 100-acre lake that's on there, is there a place for like camping or kayaking?
We are not ready to have camping yet. The master plan for this park includes camping, both hike-in primitive camping as well as drive-up camping. Those amenities are going to have to wait. Where we are right now is just our start. We're not quite ready for people to have private boat access to the lake. We don't have any way for people to get their boats to the lake, for one thing. And another thing, it sounds like 100 acres sounds large, but when you start opening things up to a large number of people, it gets small pretty quick.
How many visitors do you hope to attract to the park?
Well, gosh, anywhere from 30 to 40,000 a year might be a rough estimate.
Everyone knows the name Rockefeller. I understand this land once belonged to a member of the Rockefeller family. Is that true?
That is correct. That was James Stillman Rockefeller. He bought this land in 1938. There was a lot of other land down here that some other Rockefeller family members owned. And, you know, back in the 30s, rich industrialists would often vacation in the South during the winter. And Mr. Rockefeller bought 1,400 acres of farmland. And he was kind of, he continued the farming sort of like a hobby. And it was a way for him to get away from New York City where he worked. He and his family spent a lot of their holidays down here and some of their summer vacations as well.
Now, James Rockefeller built a home that overlooks the lake that's now part of the Carver's Creek State Park. Is there any mention in the master plan to open that home for tours?
Well, there is. We have not yet fully decided exactly how we'll use the house. Like I said, it was built in 1938, and the last time it went through any major renovations was probably in the 70s. So at this stage, it's in need of all new plumbing, all new electrical, and an all new heating and cooling system. And things that are going on to give people the idea of how this is a process. You know, we can't just make all this happen overnight. We will continue to pursue funds and plans to do more with all the facilities we have, including the house. Some of the things that we're considering to use the house for would be exhibit halls to interpret the park's resources to the public, educational space, you know, like classrooms, also areas that people could rent out for perhaps weddings or conferences, corporate retreats, things like that.
How did this land eventually become a state park?
Well, we have the Nature Conservancy of North Carolina to thank in great measure. They approached Mr. Rockefeller early 2000 and asked Mr. Rockefeller what his plans were for his lands. And Mr. Rockefeller was able to work an agreement with the Nature Conservancy to donate the 1,400 acres of the farm section of the park to the Nature Conservancy. And the Nature Conservancy donated the land to the state of North Carolina in 2010 to be used as a state park.
So the Nature Conservancy, they wanted to protect this land for the several endangered and protected plant and animal species that are there. How is the Park Service going to be involved with protecting this land?
Well, the Nature Conservancy did a wonderful job doing what we call restoration of some of the natural ecosystems out here. They've planted many longleaf pine and have also planted some of these native grasses in a large meadow that I was telling you about earlier. They did a great job and also established some prescribed burn program here. The primary ecosystem we're trying to preserve and restore is the Sandhills longleaf pine ecosystem. We will continue that management, continue the prescribed burn program. That's the primary part of the management of the longleaf pine.
Now, Carvers Creek State Park is now open to the public, open this week. As you mentioned before, it's still in the very early stages of development. What are some of your long-range plans for the property?
We always work towards and through the master plan, and we use that as a tool to plan for the future. We may want to extend one of our park roads a bit further into the parks to give people a little bit closer access to the mill pond and perhaps build a parking lot for folks down near that area. That's probably the next biggest thing on our list. And we're also going to be building a turn lane on the main highway that leads to the park for public safety for people coming into the park. Also in the works is a observation platform, a floating dock that's going to go out into the lake. We hope to have that done by January 2014.
Well, I want to say congratulations, and thank you so much for taking some time to speak with us.
You're very welcome, Jared, and tell your listeners to come visit us. Come see the park. We're happy to have them.
Anyone with a beloved pet has at some point looked into their eyes and wondered, what are you thinking about? Most of the time we just answer ourselves and say food, and that ends our contemplation. Commentator Joan Karas, however, has thought long and hard, the emphasis on long, on the subject.
I've always been a little cuckoo about animals, even worms, who are lowly but amazingly useful. They aerate the soil in our gardens and are good fish bait. As I see it, all living things exist in a perfectly integrated web, as long as we, the humans, don't screw it up. Unlike us, animals tend to keep life simple. A squirrel can live in the same little patch of trees and bushes his whole life. He doesn't long for gourmet food. He doesn't spend every Monday exchanging old nesting material for new nesting material. He doesn't monitor his chattering, for fear he might offend the blue jay or the squirrels over there in the old Carolina pine. In response to that, my seventh-grade science teacher would have said, "Well, of course. Animals operate solely on instinct. They do not think and reason." I heard those exact sentences long ago. Okay, very long ago. "They do, too, think," I said loudly. In class, we had been discussing the intelligence of various animals before focusing on dogs' intelligence. There I felt on firm ground, as I had read nearly every Albert Payson Terhune book on Earth, literally dozens of books. Terhune was both an internationally famous collie breeder and a good writer. Not yielding an inch, I told my teacher, "Maybe dogs don't think like we do, but they do make decisions. Seeing-eye dogs take their blind people safely around obstacle courses they've never seen before. That's thinking." The teacher just laughed. The man stood there, arms folded at his waist, and laughed. Well, guess who has the last laugh? Since that long ago day, the number and variety of experiments focused on animal intelligence have multiplied amazingly. Scientists have documented intelligent behavior that we'd call thinking or reasoning. But it is not exactly like our process. More a matter of degree, they say. We are figuring out which animal can do what, and it's fascinating. An Asian elephant named Happy recognized herself in a mirror, something only great apes, humans, and dolphins do. We've learned that pigs are the smartest of all domesticated animals. How do we know? Because the pig can solve a problem he's never seen before. He loves to be clean and uses mud for sunscreen only, as he cannot perspire. He has a better sense of smell than any dog and performs perfectly as a watch pig. Unlike dogs, pigs on watch do not take naps, according to farmers in Europe. And chimps? On one famous memory test, the chimps outperformed the humans. So, folks, okay. We are smarter than animals, and that should help anyone with a self-esteem problem. But they aren't just unthinking hunks of protoplasm either. The little tree rats we call squirrels are actually quite clever, especially at pretending to hide food in one place and actually putting it in another. True, squirrels can't do algebra, but hey, I can't either.
Joan Karas is a children's book author who lives in Beaufort. Her latest book is Magic at the Bed and Biscuit, published by Candlewick Press.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. It's fall webworm time. Try to say that fast three times in a row. What are fall webworms? Well, have you noticed masses of webbing on the end of tree branches with dead brown leaves in the middle? These are fall webworms. These particular caterpillars feed on over 600 species of trees. And they're a type of tiger moth. There are two forms of fall webworms here in North Carolina. One is red-headed with yellow spots, and that's the caterpillar is red-headed with yellow spots. The other has a black head and black spots. Both are a whitish moth, some with spots, some without. And all of the caterpillars are very hairy and are fairly easy to identify. The easiest way to identify webworms is by the massive webbing that they spin. That's their nest. Each nest might contain hundreds of the webworms and the leaves that the webworm is currently feeding on. As they grow and expand across the branch, eating more leaves, the nest grows with them. The nests are found in late summer and early fall, right now. And these particular insects feed for about 6 weeks. Once they've finished feeding, the caterpillars will spin a cocoon and stay there through the winter. Next spring, they'll emerge as moths, which will mate, then lay eggs, and begin the cycle of fall webworms once again. So what should you do if you find fall webworms in your trees? Well, the best thing to do if you can reach the nest is simply break it apart with a stick. If they're way up high in a tree, use a bigger stick. If you can't reach them, it's really not a worry. Very, very rarely will fall webworms cause any long-term damage. And when they do, it's on young trees, if there's too big of an infestation. And if the tree is young, well, you can reach the nest to break it open. When you break open the nest, you expose the webworm larvae to birds and diseases and parasites, all sorts of things that will take care of them for you. If you feel that you absolutely must spray something on the tree where the webworms are, well, don't bother spraying the insecticide on the nest itself because the webbing is going to protect the caterpillars. What you need is to spray the leaves just immediately adjacent to the nest, just the ones right next to it, because that's the next thing the webworms are going to eat. But let me reiterate again, you don't need to spray anything. You don't need to worry about controlling fall webworms. They're just not going to cause any damage that the tree can't easily recover from. Now, what's the difference between fall webworms and eastern tent caterpillars? Eastern tent caterpillars also form webs in trees, but they form their webs in the early spring. And instead of forming the web on the tips of branches, those webs are formed in the crotch of trees. So now you know the difference. You can watch for the fall webworms and break open the nest if you see them, but mostly just don't worry about it. Most of those trees were going to lose those leaves anyway in just a few weeks. But do break open the nest. Enjoy looking at the beautiful, hairy caterpillars inside. And then move on to something else in the garden. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.